Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 12:54 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 13th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, I'd like to first apologize for the static that came through on the first run of the audio yesterday. For some reason, my computer decided to put something else in as my default microphone. I really should have checked it and played the audio, but I didn't do that, and I do apologize. Well, I thought that today, because I'll be going on vacation next Tuesday, and that will be Tuesday will be the last day of me contributing. We've had a number of very generous subscribers who have contributed articles, so I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised with the quality of the input that you're going to get while I'm away. But I'm always trepidatious about going away when I look at markets, because anything can happen, and very often does. So let's take some time out and think about where are we in terms of the long term. I think that really is something that doesn't seem to be getting a whole pile of attention in the current market environment, because everyone's worried about trade wars. And there are legitimate reasons for that consideration. But I think let's just start out and think about what do markets do over the long term in terms of nominal pricing. And if we look at the Dow Jones, it ranged between approximately 1900 and about the middle of the 1920s, and then it took off. And it went from 100 to 400 in the space of a few years, and that was really the roaring 20s, and it was a phenomenal bull market, and then it gave up all of it. The market fell by almost 90%, and then it spent the next few decades ranging. And if we look at history, we get these periods where you get phenomenal price appreciation, and then you get these incredibly lengthy ranges that feel like they're going to go on forever. But by and large, these ranges last for anything up to about 15 years, and then you get a breakout. And after the breakout, you get a secular bull market. So during the last bull market, the Dow Jones went from 1,000 to approximately 10,000. And back then, there was people thought that it was well on its way to reaching 100,000. And it subsequently went sideways for approximately 13 years. And then it broke out. And now we're at 25,000. Well, 25,000 is a big psychological number, and the index closed above it in here today. So when we think about where are we in terms of this long-term cycle, well, it's not so long ago that the market had been ranging in a very volatile and prolonged manner, and we know that historically when they break up and away from these very lengthy periods, that they tend to go on and rally for a prolonged period of time. So the chances are that the Dow Jones, or any measure of the stock market on Wall Street, is in a secular bull market. And when we compare that to gold, well, we can see that this very long-term chart has got this interval between major peaks in the stock market that is approximately 35 years in duration. So the last important peak was in 1999, and therefore, if history over the last 100 years holds, then the next one could be sometime in the mid-2030s. Well, we're still only in 2018, and what that suggests is that we're still in the reasonably early stages of a secular bull market. But, of course, there is no bull market that isn't punctuated occasionally by cyclical bear markets and the occasional recession. But there is a difference, and it is that in a cyclical bull market and you get a recession, well, then it could be very deleterious. And in a secular bull market, when you get a recession, then the pullbacks can be sharp, short and sharp, but that they do not give way to these decade and longer ranges. So that's an important, I think, a differentiator. If we are in fact in a secular bull market, then whenever we get the next recession, it is going to be traumatic, and it is going to be surprising for a lot of people, but it's probably not going to last for the same amount of time in terms of the break that it puts on nominal price appreciation. So That is, I think, one of the most important characteristics. That does not mean that there aren't going to be lots of people worried about what the next secular or what the next recession is going to look like. I posted a video of Paul Tudor Jones and the CEO of Goldman Sachs earlier this week, and they were saying, well, golly, when the next recession comes, the Federal Reserve isn't going to have any of the policy tools that it had available to it previously, and that it's going to be worse than 2008. And that was almost a throwaway remark, but that's one of the most, I think, the biggest fears that most people have, that we never really successfully recovered from the financial crisis, and that everything has been built on a house of cards. And when we think about that, the reality is that the Federal Reserve is now reducing the size of its balance sheet, and the pace of that balance sheet runoff is picking up. That and we know that, we can see it very clearly on the chart. But what is less remarked upon is that when we look at the total assets of the major central banks, we get a similar story, that it isn't just that the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet, it's that on aggregate, the size of central bank balance sheets is contracting. And it's not just the Federal Reserve, but the ECB is in the process of winding down its purchasing. So they expect to be finished adding new supply to the market in September. Well, we're in July now, so we're really only talking about 6 weeks from now that the ECB will have stopped adding new funds to the global market. Now, when we look at the Bank of Japan, then we get something else, that the Bank of Japan's balance sheet has been one of the primary tools for the market, and that has helped to devalue the currency, and it's also been helping to support the stock market. They have been buying ETFs as part of their central bank stimulus measures. But we can also see from this chart that yes, the total of purchases is increasing, but the pace of the purchases has moderated. Nonetheless, this was an important week for the yen. When we look at the yen on this longer term chart, and I think I need to update it to what we've seen in here today, but this is a really quite a lengthy range, and the dollar came off of really quite depressed levels from the lows that were posted back in 2011, and now we're back around mid-range and around this psychological 110 area. The yen has been ranging in a volatile manner between approximately the 75 area and 150 for much of the last 20 odd years, and it's approximately mid-range right now. So at I think that the most likely scenario is that the dollar is going to range higher from here, and that this is an important breakout that we've seen in here this week. But it's really a move above 120 would really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment for the dollar and a supply-dominated environment for the yen. And that might be a bit of a big ask, considering that the Bank of Japan appears to be angling towards reducing the size of their purchases. They don't want to see a crash in the currency. They just want to have a weaker currency. The most important thing that we've seen in this very long-term chart of the Nikkei is that it is now sustaining the move above at the 20,000 level. And this is important because every single time that it got up to test at this 20,000 level since the early 1990s, it failed. And when it failed, it went on to make a new low. And that changed in approximately 2016, that it got up to 20,000 and it did not make a new low, and in fact recouped the decline and is now sustaining the move above 20,000. Well, when a market that has been going sideways for more than 20 years breaks out, then we have to sit up and pay attention that something very definitely different has occurred, and that this probably represents a move into a new secular bull market. And it's being led higher by small caps. And the second section index has been an area of our has been a really a very reliable lead indicator for the market for years. It accelerated to its peak back in January, and it has been in a lengthier period of consolidation since then. But importantly, it is continuing to hold the region of the trend mean. Now, one of the things that I've noticed in my travels to Japan is that the number of foreigners that we've met was quite surprising. That and the number of women that are working in what I would consider to be rather heavy manual labor tasks is also surprising. That's not something that I've seen anywhere else. On the one hand, you see immigrants in just about all countries. And for example, when you go to China in Guangzhou, there is a substantial population of Africans. When you go to Japan, you don't expect to see a lot of immigrants, but when you walk around and you talk to people, you find out that the people that are helping you are from Vietnam or from Korea, and that's not what is expected. So Japan has long been thought of as this country that was completely against immigration, but there's a simple fact of the matter that they need more workers. That and that is also why you have a number of women that are working in these heavy manual labor type jobs. That it's quite unusual that when you go to a hotel that it is a woman that is carrying bags. It from when you come from Europe or North America, I've you it's not something that is that sits well in a chivalrous kind of society, that you would immediately try and take the bag from a woman who's trying to carry it for you, whereas that is just not something that women generally do in just about any other country. I've never seen a woman delivering beer kegs, and the first time I've ever seen that is in Japan, and that tells us that there is this acute shortage of workers, and that that we are seeing the liberalization and the equitable division of labor is not really yet evident. That women are being forced into these jobs that require manual labor rather than being employed for their cognitive abilities. So you still have this imbalance between men and women in the country, but one I think has to at least hope that that will change over time, and not least as you have a dearth of people in just about all facets of the economy. That also means that there's going to be more immigration, and generally speaking, immigrants create growth. And I think that that is what we're beginning to see in Japan. That is one of the reasons why we're getting a change in this secular environment, that there is this undercurrent that is, I think, underappreciated by the market, that Japan's secular bear market is over. And I think that is one of the most important longer-term trends out there. Well, when we think about the other big trends that are out there, well, we have to think about China. And I go to China on a at least an annual basis, and every time I go there is surprising for the rapid pace of development and change that we see there. But the stock market tends to think on a day-to-day, on a quarter-to-quarter basis, and the Chinese administration tends to think on a decade-to-decade basis. China's unabashed ambition is to be the most significant global economic power, and everything that they are doing is with an aim towards achieving that goal. And unfortunately, the stock market is a secondary objective in that course of events. China needs to have a a blue water navy, and it needs to have a more technologically capable economy if it's going to compete internationally, and that's exactly what they're doing. But building this kind of infrastructure does not happen overnight. It happens over the course of years and even decades. So they're fully committed to that, and they're going to ensure that they end up with a technologically advanced economy. There are problems in China with leverage because people have used the property market as their primary savings route, and there has been massive savings have been plowed into the property markets. And because there is no sales, excuse me, there is no property tax, that the cost of carry on property is zero. And that means that you can buy your properties, you need never rent them out because you don't have a cost of carry. When you've got high property taxes, then you're in a more difficult scenario if you're paying off a mortgage with no income. So people then in higher property tax regions generally have to rent out their spare properties. That's just not the case in China. And often properties are sold without second finishing. So you have to invest money to do them up, however you want them done before somebody moves in. That represents additional costs that may not be recouped by the seller. So then you get properties that tend to be in what has an appearance of disrepair because a second finishing doesn't get done before they're sold. But all of that is dependent on the flow of credit. So the A-share index has been pulling back just about all of this year, and it has been led lower by the banks. And I remember I was at a dinner in China a couple of years ago, and there was a senior banker from CITIC Securities was the spouse of one of my wife's friends, and it was back in I think probably about 2015. He was saying that that hedge funds were all the go among clients. But what he meant by hedge funds are not what we tend to understand by hedge funds. He was talking about private lending organizations. And that had ballooned in importance for the major banks and indeed the regional banks by approximately 2016 and 17. And it represented this non-bank lending represented massive leverage for both the investors in the structures and indeed for the banks. And the central bank came in and really moved to act against it at the beginning of this year. And it has pretty much disappeared. And it has particularly inconvenienced the regional banking sector because they had been depending on this non-bank lending to really help to source additional funds. Now, when we look at the shadow banking sector in China, you can see clearly that there was this massive move in lending to non-financials in 2016, and it has pretty much evaporated by now. And what that then created was this desire to find credit somewhere else. So China's foreign debts went up to about $1.8 trillion by March of this year. So that's why China has decided to stop all dollar lending. It's not so much about the fact that the renminbi is now falling, although that is obviously going to be part of the equation, but much more it's about protecting its domestic market from these dollar loans. That the renminbi was in additional negative territory in here today. When we look at the chart and take the labels off of it, this is a massive break of trend. And the dollar's underperformance against the renminbi now appears to be over. And it looks increasingly likely that the region of the 200-day moving average is going to be an area of support for the dollar rather than an area of resistance, and that we're in a new dollar-dominated environment. And This has been largely manufactured by the Chinese administration. They're certainly worried about trade wars, and for an export-oriented country, then that's an important characteristic. When we think about just what countries are most going to be affected by the strength of the dollar, well, when you think about the foreign exchange denominated emerging market debt by sector, well, China might have 1.8 trillion, but as a proportion of its economy, that is quite small. Whereas when you look at foreign denominated debt in countries like Turkey and Argentina and Hungary, well, that is a clear rationale for why there is downward pressure on their currencies, and when you have declining standards of governance. And the Turkish lira today was in sharply negative territory. Well, this, I think, helps to just ram home the point that governance is everything, and that is as true for the equity markets in developed in emerging markets as it is for developed markets. And a number of countries now have this governance deficit, and it is being translated into pressure on their respective stock markets now that the dollar is rallying. Well, China's efforts to contain the threat from trade wars obviously figure in the devaluation of the currency, and they're likely to continue to leave the currency devalue as long as it suits their longer term aims. The catalyst that for change in the underperformance of China is likely to be represented by a change to this pressure that's been put on the financial sector. Now, they have already been cutting reserve requirements for the banks. That's certainly one measure. But what we would need to see is a change to the default parameters. The one big uncertainty that we have with China today is we simply do not know what the natural rate of default is. We've had this problem with bad loans sitting on the books of Chinese banks for years. And if we think about Cinda Asset Management, its genesis was in fact in the as a bad bank for the bad loans that occurred in the market in the 1990s. Well, it is deteriorating sharply right now. And this has been really quite an accelerated decline, and it really helps to highlight just how much risk there is in some of these markets. That it has an estimated PE of 3.5, and it is yielding 7.8%, and it's still trending lower. So this tells us that we are at an extreme point right now, and that some of these assets are being sold off in a very aggressive manner, that there is value starting to come back into some of these Chinese assets, but that it is going to need some form of catalyst. But nonetheless, China now deserves a higher risk premium. I think that this is one of the most important characteristics, that when we start to think about markets in terms of governance, then there are a number of aspects that dictate whether an investment destination has improving or declining standards of governance. The things that we clearly look for are that you have a respect for minority shareholder interests, and that you have recourse to the courts, so that you must have an independent judiciary, so that if your shareholding or your possessions, your property rights are impaired, that you have recourse to the courts. And it's really handy if you have an independent or a free press, so that your case against corrupt officials can be publicized. Well, China doesn't have any of that. And now it also is waging an outright war on the freedom of association. And it is also waging a war against any kind of potential rebellion against the administration. Approximately 10% of the male population of Xinjiang is currently under arrest. And for that represents millions of people that are being held in re-education camps. And this is the kind of thing that goes completely unreported. China is engaged in industrial espionage. And these are not new stories. This is something that's been going on for years, but it is now gaining greater attention from the international community, and most particularly the Trump administration. And it was inevitable that eventually this rise of China would eventually be challenged. And this is not a situation that is going to be, I think, solved quickly. So when we think about the longer term outlook, China is a competitor to much of the West. It has been the primary beneficiary of globalization. And Europe has probably been the second biggest beneficiary, but not Europe on aggregate, but primarily the creditor nations like Germany that have been the primary beneficiaries of the globalization. Whereas it is the working classes that have been eviscerated by the march of globalization. And the pain that those people have suffered over decades has only really been solved by the rise of the welfare state. But people in a lot of different countries have experienced the pressure that has come onto them from the aftermath of the solution to the credit crisis. That by bailing out the banks, taxes were raised and benefits were cut, and there was the kind of people that had been disenfranchised by the rise of globalization had no recourse to better jobs. And they're now voting en masse for outside politicians. And this is very similar to what we see in markets, that the status quo persists in the range for a lengthy period of time, and expectations for future potential deteriorate the longer the range persists for. When you get a breakout, it is necessarily surprising, and then we get extreme moves relative to the staid environment of the range. And that's exactly what we're getting in the political front. That we had this contraction of polarity in the political sphere, where there wasn't really a great deal of difference between the left and the right. And now we're getting the rise of populist movements that are extreme in terms of what they're looking for relative to what was the status quo previously. And this represents a new trend. And what people want is they want higher standards of living. They want to go back to the kind of standard of living that they had become accustomed to, and that they're not going to stop voting for extreme candidates until they get what they want. But all of this is inflationary. And it might not be inflationary right away, but the US CPI is creeping higher, and the 10-year yield is consolidating in the region of 3%. And I think these are important points that we have the potential for inflation to become a significant issue. And I think the market that is going to be most reflective of that is at the US 10-year TIPS, because there's no additional new supply planned. And the yield this week is right in the region of the moving average, and it has been ranging below 1% since 2013. So this is a relatively lengthy range, and there has been an upward bias to the yield since 2016. A sustained move below the trend mean would be required to question that this isn't going to break on the upside at some point over the next 12 months. Well, when we think about the secular trends, that Wall Street is probably in a secular bull market, and then Japan is in a new secular bull market, and that Europe has been ranging for 18 years. Well, Europe has got some challenges in the fact that it is not internally cohesive, that the the internal contradictions of the single currency are likely to continue to be a problem for the foreseeable future. And really, that index is going to have to break above 400 in order to demonstrate that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. I think the longer-term chart of currencies, and particularly the dollar index, is certainly worth highlighting here, because the dollar is capable of having multi-year bull markets, and it trended lower for about 18 months, and that downtrend is now over. 100 on the dollar index has been an area of resistance from time to time since at least 1986. There was a brief period between early 2000 and about 2003 when it traded above that level, but more often than not, over the last 30 years, it has spent time below it. Well, I think that the most likely scenario is now that we're probably going to see a retest of the 100 level at some point over the next 12 months. Then the question will be whether it is going to break on the upside. One thing that we have got some evidence for is that the Wall Street tends to do best when it is both performing as a relative strength leader and is also benefiting from the strength of the dollar. And that is what we're getting right now. That is part of the reason why the Nasdaq has been such a remarkable performer. And it consolidated in the region of the 2000 peak for a couple of years and then broke out. And it was at another new high in here today. The most important thing the index has done in the last while has been to sustain a move above that 7,000 level. So this is, I think, an important point. The Nasdaq has been trending higher in a very steep manner for the last few years, and it has been prone to occasional periods where we've had more volatile trading, but it continues to hold the upward bias. It continues to find support in the region of the trend mean following these somewhat larger pullbacks. And if we simply look at the market and ask ourselves simple filter questions, is it trending or ranging? Well, it's definitely trending. If it's trending, what are the consistency characteristics? Well, the consistency characteristics are that it's going up really quickly, but that occasionally it does have somewhat larger pullbacks, and that those pullbacks coincide with reversions towards the mean. That the progression of higher reaction lows generally tends to hold. And then, is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics? Well, it does tend to accelerate from time to time, but generally speaking, those accelerations have been unwound by medium-term corrections, and then the trend has persisted. Well, a type 2 would be a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, followed by a range below the trend mean, and then a breakdown. We have not seen that, and we haven't seen the ranging time and size, long, volatile, and a very messy type 3 top formation either. And therefore, this remains a reasonably consistent advance. Now, one of the points that I find particularly interesting about the case, or excuse me, the CAPE index, if I pull up multiple, then we can see the Shiller PE ratio. And when we look at the Shiller PE ratio, I really wonder whether back in the 1990s, when the index was pushing on to new all-time highs, whether people weren't shouting bubble, because that was probably not heard by the wider market. I think there are two big points that have to be made about the Shiller PE ratio. The first is that we had a collapse in earnings in 2008, and we had some substantial pullback in terms of the of mean reversion in terms of the PE, and it got down to about 15. And now we're at 32, so the PE has doubled since about 2009. But the market today is much more internationally oriented than it was before, and does that, I think, does it? justify a higher multiple? That's a big question. And I don't think that it is possible to answer it until we have the next crisis and find out where the PE then eventually settles afterwards. There is an argument that potentially we are just simply in a higher valuation metric right now. But the most important thing about this index is that it's not a timing tool. Just because we have a historically high valuation, it does not mean that this is the peak valuation. There is nothing on the chart tells us where the peak is. And it's not until the value starts to pull back, and pull back not simply a little, but in a dynamic manner, that we would have confirmation. But if that were to happen, then we would have a clear message in terms of the stock market's performance. When we look at the S&P 500, then we're not presented with topping activity. There was a slight acceleration at the end of last year. We did have the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and since then we have had this progression of higher reaction lows. Now, I've been thinking that this was a medium-term correction within a secular bull market, and we define a medium-term correction as anything that lasts from about 6 to 18 months, or maybe even 2 years. And with the Nasdaq breaking out and the Russell 2000 breaking out, then the likelihood is that the chances are that this correction on Wall Street is going to be on the shorter side of that time horizon, and that the most likely scenario is that it will be breaking higher. But we also have to bear in mind that the CAPE, the cyclically adjusted PE, is at high levels, and that would suggest that we are approaching this third psychological perception stage of the bull market, which is often characterized by acceleration. And when we look at the FANG stocks, well, then we have evidence of where the acceleration might start to come from, because Amazon is picking up pace on the upside. And this is a share that is prone to acceleration, and it is going up quite quickly. The outperformance of the technology sector, and I think primarily it is markets that have accelerated and have adopted the subscription business model. It is the subscription business model is the rallying cry for Silicon Valley today. There was a CEO of an IPO that he launched his IPO by releasing a book extolling the benefits of the subscription business model. And the subscription business model works best for companies like Amazon and Cisco and the games manufacturers and the cybersecurity companies, where they are producing products that people really need. That if you're using Microsoft for your job, and you stop paying your subscription to Office 365, well, then you're not going to have Word or Excel. You're not going to have your Outlook. And this is factoring through into the benefits for these companies. And it is also making what had previously been highly cyclical business models much more modelable. And by becoming more modelable, it means that their financials are more transparent to investors, and that is justifying their somewhat higher valuations. So there is a strong likelihood that it is the subscription business model is going to lead us into this third psychological perception stage of the bull market. So it is these subscription-oriented companies that we need to keep the closest eye on, because when they eventually roll over, well, then that will be the clearest indicator that this medium-term bull market has run its course. Now, there are a number of other points that are worth highlighting and worth keeping an eye on. The first is the yield curve spread. And Jamie Dimon in the JP Morgan, excuse me, that's Jamie Dimon in the JP Morgan conference call today, was saying that the yield curve spread may not be as useful now as it was before. Well, we will see, because it's at 24 basis points today. It's contracted by about 5 basis points this week alone. And we are rapidly coming down towards that zero bound. Well, a yield curve, an inverted yield curve, has been a reliable lead indicator for future recessions on all but one occasion over the course of the last 40 years. And we are very close to a negative reading right now. It can be a lead indicator, though, for anything from 6 to 18 months out. If we do have an accelerating market and people decide to discount it, then just like we had in 2005, that there is the possibility that the market just keeps going, and that will create the bubbly activity, which will then contribute to an eventual top. And that would suggest that it would be the companies that have gone up the most, particularly those that have got sky-high PEs and do not have an easy route to making money, that are going to come under the most pressure. Then, when we look at the high yield spread, well, generally speaking, if credit conditions are getting tighter, well, that is going to be felt fastest by the companies that rely heaviest on cheap liquidity. So high yield spreads broke out last week, and they paused a little bit in here this week, but they have not pushed back down below the trend mean. And when we look at the European high yield spreads, then we get a similar situation, but they have been trending higher since December. So that also helps to emphasize that Europe has got tighter conditions than might be readily apparent, and that it is a significant risk that the ECB is about to reduce the size of, or sorry, eliminate its purchases of bonds. And China's and Asia's high yield spreads are rising rather quickly. So I think that is also worth keeping an eye on. That we definitely have a situation where we're getting this change in terms of the outlook for the credit markets. Then, when we look at banks, well, we tend to think about banks as liquidity providers, and banks should do well in a bull market environment. As liquidity providers in a liquidity-fueled bull, they should be doing well. Well, the S&P 500 banks index has been the clear outperformer among global counterparties, and it was not able to hold its advance in here today. And it was off its, oh, excuse me, this week, it was off its low in here today, but that 320 point level is an important one. When we look at the regional banks index in the USA, then this is another important index, and it is now back testing the region of its trend mean. Well, if the regional banks are not performing, then that says more about the financial conditions in the domestic US economy than the S&P 500 banks. When we look at the European banks, then they remain under pressure. And there remain still big questions about bad loans and their ability to trade their way out of what is a very, I think, and lengthy, significant challenge to their entire business models. Now, when we think about the commodity markets, well, it does look like the dollar is returning to strength, and that's particularly the case against emerging markets. Now, the Mexican peso has been rallying, so that has helped to stabilize the Latin America dollar index, and the Brazilian real is in the region of the four level, so this is an area where we may get some support coming in. But medium term, it's hard to make a case that we're going to have a significant appreciation in these currencies. When we look at the commodity complex, it has had the legs cut out from under it over the last couple of weeks because of trade war and frictions between the USA and China. Perhaps the most important of these is copper, where we've had a massive reaction against the prevailing trend, and this is rather significant. It I think really begins to question whether we're going to get the rally in commodity markets that are in the mining sector that normally is associated with the third psychological perception stage of a bull market. That generally it is cyclical shares really do pick up and do better in that kind of environment. But with this trade friction with China, that is now being questioned. Lean hogs in particular has been pulling back, and we saw the first signs that support is starting to be to come in here this just the last 2 days. Soybeans has also accelerated lower, and it is right in the region of the lows that we saw in 2008 and again in 2015. And against that background, where we've had this very accelerated decline, cotton prices have been firming up. So we're in a situation now where each commodity has to be addressed on its individual merits, that it is no longer appropriate to talk about a commodity bull market, that we can only really talk about a bull market in an individual commodity. And that represents a change. I think that also helps to highlight, when you think about the Dow gold ratio, that stocks can outperform over the lengthy medium term. Now, if we are at a point where the dollar is rallying, then that has put pressure on gold prices. And gold is now back testing the region of its progression of higher reaction lows. Now, this saucering pattern that's been developing since 2013 is dependent on the progression of higher reaction lows holding. So this is about where, if support is going to be found, that we can expect it to happen. And so far, there hasn't been a great deal of evidence that gold has been able to sustain a rally from this level, but it was off its low in here today. One point that I think is worth highlighting is that US 2-year Treasury yields are at about 2.6%, and the federal funds rate is at 2%. Everyone is expecting the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates twice more this year, and that is now being priced into the 2-year. But they're not willing to price in more than two. If that's all we get, if the Federal Reserve says that they're going to raise rates twice more and done, then that is going to take some pressure off the bond markets. It could avoid an inverted yield curve, and it could be beneficial for assets in the emerging markets if the dollar starts to steady up. But I think that it's unlikely. I think that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates until they get a recession, because that is they are worried about excesses in the economy. And that we know that bull markets and that economic expansions are generally assassinated by central banks. So what happens with the 2-year and what happens with the yield curve is important. And this we can we know what to look for in terms of the lead indicators for future recessions. But we also have to keep in mind that consistent trends are trends in motion, and that as long as the trend is consistent, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend. And I'll next record a big picture audio in the first week of August. And if you're also going on vacation, I wish you all the best.